Hi, I'm WTOP Entertainment Editor Jason Fraley, and I'm here with...
David Catlin. I'm director and adapter for Moby Dick.
Which is playing at Arena Stage from November 18th through December 24th, so right up to Christmas Eve. Let's dive right in. A bunch of us have read Moby Dick, but might have a hard time imagining how is it coming onto the stage, you know? It's a huge whale, you know? It's not like other musicals you can just adapt. How do you go about tackling such a taming a beast?
Well, it's kind of impossible, right? I mean, and I think that's one of the reasons why we love it, why we are attracted to it, because it's impossible. And you know, theater is one of those places where we all, as an audience, suspend our disbelief and we can believe in impossible things as a group, right? When you read a book, your imagination becomes your own cinematographer, right? Mm-hmm. And in a theater, that can happen too. We give you certain set elements and visual elements that lead you to begin to believe that this woman with an umbrella is an 80-ton whale, right? Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, really exciting as an audience member to be with a group of people who suddenly believe that to be true. And I think theater is just one of the rare places that can happen. And this novel, there's just so much in it that it just feels impossible to stage. So,
yeah. So you mentioned the novel, Herman Melville. They called him Ishmael as well, I think.
Yeah.
When did you read it? Back in school? Or
I read it a billion years ago when I was in college. And I was supposed to read it as part of a class, an American lit class. And I blew it off. I was a terrible student. And
not even the Cliff Notes?
Yeah, no, I didn't read it until it came to reading week, and I was like, oh God, I've got to read it. So I brewed many a pot of espresso. I ate some no-dos, which I think is just like more pure caffeine, and in a caffeinated blur, I got through it in faster than I've ever read anything in my life. And it was maybe because I hadn't slept and I was a little unguarded and exhausted. I loved it. I mean, my heart was pounding probably from the caffeine, but I think also from the story. The sea adventure was just thrilling. I couldn't turn the pages fast enough. And then flash forward 20 years for me, and a artistic colleague in Chicago approached me and said, I'm adapting Moby Dick myself. You want to be part of this collaborative process to not collaborate and make come together and make a single production, but to collaborate, share ideas, and make distinct productions. And so there were actually three of us, and we made three different versions of Moby Dick. And ours is very, our theater company in Chicago we're Looking Glass Theater Company, and we incorporate a lot of music and dance and visual storytelling that feels vibrant and sometimes cinematic, and we incorporate elements of circus. We want our audiences to feel like they're in the story and experiencing it and feeling it, not just hearing it, but really feeling it in their guts, and so that it's a visceral experience, a kind of a muscular experience where you're drawn to the edge of your seat by the story. And we literally have people flying overhead with these elements of circus. We thought we can put actors in the air and make the air feel like the rigging of the ship. We could put actors in the air and make the air feel like we're now underwater. There's a character.
Right, like the weightlessness of
The kind of defying of gravity and moving through that space.
Different defying gravity than Wicked. Different play.
Different. Well,
but
maybe.
Yeah, you never
maybe.
Know.
I mean, that's also a fantastical kind of breathtaking story, too.
Yeah.
And different, right?
But you've turned the idea is you've turned Arena Stage into a bit of a fishbowl for the under.
Yeah, it feels like it.
And then also on the deck of the ship.
Yeah.
Wow.
We had an audience member last night who we start previewing tonight, but we had an audience member who saw The Invited Dress, and she came up to me and she said, Was this theater designed for this play? It feels like it was designed for this play. And there is something about that space that feels right for this play. It feels like you're inside an aquarium,
right,
with this giant whale.
In fact, our listeners can't see this now, but we're actually floating around in an aquarium right now. And this glass enclosed nerve center is just a fish tank right now. You can't see it, but.
And there's lots of seaweed. And are those mermaids or sirens over there?
I think it's a siren.
Yeah. Well, why is she beckoning siren to us? Yeah. Should we follow? I don't know.
There's
maybe
like
that's
seaweed all over the switchboard right now. It's interesting. I'm having a hard time holding my breath.
Yeah. Do you want a fish stick?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. take me into the actors. Who plays Ahab? Captain Ahab.
A guy named Christopher Donahue, who is one of those just most brilliant, soulful actors. As a human being, he's kind of this beautiful, beautiful, lonely soul. And he loves the ocean as a human. He does as a person, and so he fits right into this kind of story of this monomaniacal leader who's a little bit lonely. You know, when we think of Ahab, we think about what a kind of mad, monomaniac, sort of crazy soul he is, or just how obsessed he is with this white whale. But I also think that in a way, what he's selling is really interesting. I feel like in our lives, we are surrounded by stuff and things and messages we're supposed to return, and all of these, whether it's social networks or texts we're supposed to return or emails we're supposed to return, all these things tugging at us for attention. And what he's about is at first seems like this noble task. It's where you know, his idea is that Moby Dick represents evil itself, evil incarnate. And he seeks to go and rid the world of this evil whale that has smashed many whale boats, that has killed many men. And so the crew rallies around it and thinks, yes, sign me up for this. Let's go slay not just a dragon, but the ultimate dragon. And so it's compelling what he's selling. And I have felt that way too sometimes, where I want the world to disappear a little bit and I can just focus on that one thing to whether it's art or my family or some hobby. I mean, I think we get that, right? Mm-hmm. We want that, the world, or a movie we're caught up in, or a play, or book. We want it to just kind of disappear, and that's what he's about. Unfortunately, that obsession or that being consumed by something, he can't let go of it, and it becomes dangerous. Like many things in our lives, we can often get too deep into something. We cannot let go of it and disengage from it, and we become obsessed and addicted by it, right? And I think that's a danger for all of us. And in fact, Starbuck in the play, who is also the namesake of a famous coffee chain, he represents balance, right? He represents he wants to kill whales for his living, not be killed by them for theirs. So he's that sense of balance, and it's up to him to take Ahab and change him from this doom-filled course. And there's a moment right towards the end of the play where he has this beautiful moment with Ahab, where Ahab sees in Starbuck's eyes, he sees Starbuck's humanity, and sees his own, Ahab's own wife and child in Starbuck's eyes, and there's a moment where it feels like he's going to turn the ship around and head for safety, for home, for family, and that everything's going to be okay. But something, is it fate, is it Ahab, is it God, is it who, that jams him on, that drives him to this immutable confrontation with the white whale, with his obsession, with his fate. And in some ways, I think we get Ahab, and we get all the characters in the book, and maybe that's why it's so important to me, certainly, but why it has become an important book, because even as we can see the negative side of Ahab, on some very human level, we get him. We get that. The kind of need for that.
Definitely.
And, yeah.
And back when you were reading it for the first time, I bet you saw, and you said you were drinking all the coffee to, to get through it. Yeah. You saw Starbucks too.
Yeah, I did. Well, yes. Yeah.
No, but talk about, speaking of that though, talk about sort of the pop culture impact of Moby Dick. You got Starbucks.
Yeah.
You wouldn't have probably the last half of Jaws if not for Moby Dick.
Right.
I mean, Captain Quinn is nothing but not Captain Ahab.
Very much. Very much so.
But just talk about sort of how it's still very much a part of our whole cultural understanding.
Oh, yeah. It's quick fun fact. There is a guy named Richard Melville who is a descendant of Herman Melville that you all know as the singer and musician Moby.
Yes. There you go.
You know, when Melville wrote it, it came out in 1851, the country was feeling a little divided, was on the verge of civil war, right? And hopefully we're not there.
Right.
But we feel a little divided right now. Yeah. I think we do. And we feel that. We feel the anxiety at the kind of rhetoric and on some level, wouldn't it be nice to just go to sea and kind of avoid that? So that feels very present. The kind of central relationship here is between Ishmael and Queequeg. Ishmael is, you know, it's an opening line we all know, right? Mm. Call me Ishmael. Mm-hmm. And his name, he doesn't say, hey, everybody, my name's Ishmael. He says, call me Ishmael.
For a reason.
For a reason. Yeah. And he, you know, if you know your Old Testament, like I don't, or if, like me, you've read the annotation, that the little footnote at the bottom of the page that reminds us that Ishmael is the unborn bastard son of Abraham who is cast out into the desert. Mm. Ishmael is the original outcast. And so our narrator, in that famous first line, says, I am an outcast, the original outcast.
What a beautiful way of saying, instead of saying, I am the outcast.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It captures it. So
Call me. And so he is alone. He's unconnected. He's feeling the kind of divisiveness. It's a damp, drizzly November in his soul. And he's just, so he goes to sea. He's drawn to the water's edge. And you know, for those of us who've had the opportunity to stand in front of a massive body of water, it is both calming but also unsettling to stand there and know that beneath the beautiful silvery surface that reflects those technicolor sunsets, it's at once beautiful but also dangerous. Below lurk monsters, real and metaphoric, right? And
makes us seem very small compared to all that.
Yeah, makes us seem small, right? Yeah, and that's calming too, but also thrilling. And at that water's edge in New Bedford, specifically in the story, he meets somebody from the other side of the world, Queequeg, the cannibal harpooner, the quote-unquote savage, right? Somebody who is so different in just every possible way. He's got tattoos all over his body. He wields this terrifying, death-delivering harpoon. He's scary to Ishmael. He is this other, right? He's just very, 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 very different. And yet, Ishmael, who fears him, who is frightened by him, who's ignorant of him, very quickly begins to see that this person who is so different is deeply like him, that they are connected. Perhaps by their sense of feeling like outcasts, perhaps by their loneliness, perhaps by their feeling unmoored and rudderless, right? And so they decide to go whaling. We know a lot about whaling, right? We get to see these National Geographic great documentaries and Discovery Channel stuff, and we see that these massive creatures are not the fearsome dragons underwater that they probably were thought to be. We know that, but at the time they were terrifying, and they were riled up a little bit because people would go out and poke them with pointy harpoons and lances, and so they would smash whale boats with their tails that would loom 20 feet out of the air. They would snap the whale boats in half with jaws that were the length of the tallest man, the tallest NBA player, right? With teeth that were the size of your fist, but much sharper, that could reap away a man's leg the way a mower reaps away a blade of grass. These were fearsome creatures. And so these brave men would get onto whaling ships and go to the other, travel to the unknown other part, other side of the world, to get out into little tiny whale boats to brave, to bring back precious, precious oil that would light the street lights and make the world safer, that would light candles and lights in home. This is before oil was discovered in Titusville, Pennsylvania. And so this is how we brought light into the world. And so what a noble task, right? Yeah. And then enter Ahab with an even more noble task, to go and slay evil itself, right? Yeah. To rid the world of evil. And back to your original point about how it feels prescient and immediate, you know, we as humans can have noble intentions and we can become misguided, right?
In our obsessive,
passionate pursuit. Sometimes we are not reasoned and we plow forward and make decisions and are guided by misinformation, right? There's this prophecy that hangs around Ahab that hemp alone can kill him. And it's very much like Shakespeare's Scottish play, Macbeth, where there's this prophecy that is misinterpreted by this leader. And so he believes that hemp alone, that must mean the gallows, that somebody, but you can't be hung at sea. Yeah. And so he proceeds on this collision course with the white whale, with his own fate, presuming that he's fine, he's safe, he's immortal.
Because he's away from the gallows.
Yeah, he's away from the gallows.
Mind, yeah.
So he's okay, right?
And we all know what happens.
Yeah, and unbeknownst to him, if he just looked up, the ship is just covered with hemp and rigging and whale lines that are ultimately going to be his undoing.
His demise, yeah.
Yep.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
But I love that idea, and I'm sure, you know, Melville writing this, and you as a director, I love that fatalistic idea, because you can pepper those rope lines all in the background and have that, you know, that motif there is foreshadowing that the audience might not even realize until.
Yeah,
you know,
and it's a big part of it's really a big, the plot, the prophecy in the plot drives on that. But also, if it's a play about feeling, if part of it is a story about feeling disconnected or Ishmael's feeling like an outcast, these lines, these ropes, are ways that we connect to things. We connect to each other. Even thinking about the moment where, when we're in the womb, we're connected to our mother by the umbilical
cord,
right? We are. These lines help connect us. Even the lines on Ahab's map connect them from where they are to where they want to be. Queequeg's tattoos were tattooed by this seer on his island, on his fictitious island of Kokovoko, who had a vision of the future. And so his tattoos, these lines of his tattoos, connect him to Providence. And so lines and rope become a very important metaphor for this story.
I love how down in all the imagery and symbolism you are. It's perfect. It's perfect for the director. Are you kidding me? This is what we don't get when sometimes when you talk to actors, you get one side of it.
Yeah.
But I love having a director in. This is fantastic. Awesome. You mentioned who plays Ahab. Who is our Ishmael? Who's the narrator?
A guy named Jamie Abelson, who is just a beautiful human being. He feels like any of us. He is just he's in a way like a cipher where we are able to project ourselves onto him very easily, and so his voice is clarion clear, and he just draws us in and brings us into the story in a beautiful way, and we feel as he does as we go through it. He just is terrific, and he's present throughout the play. In the novel, the character Ishmael kind of disappears. We lose sight. He's there in the narration, but we lose sight of him. He becomes eclipsed by Ahab's charisma. And so even though the scenes become more about Ahab from the moment he enters, Ishmael is there recording it, and we get to experience it through his lens and see it through his eyes, and begin to add it up. And there's a great scene. So the end of Act One is Ahab rallying the crew and getting them to sign on to this noble, noble quest. And somewhere towards the end of Act Two, Ahab begins to turn. And instead of having this kind of holy ritual to get the men to make a vow, he has a profane ritual where he baptizes this new harpoon, not in the name of the Father, but in the name of the devil. And the crew, and specifically Ishmael, become very aware that this thing that was at once very, very noble is no longer so noble and is becoming profane and bloody.
He's gone off the deep end.
Yeah. And then from that moment on, there's a series of ominous portents that potentially lead us to our doom. Until that moment, that hopeful moment when Starbuck and Ahab meet, and Starbuck sees, Ahab sees his wife and family in Starbuck's eyes, and there is that hopeful, hopeful moment. Yeah.
Awesome. And you mentioned earlier about the title character, how it's with an umbrella. Explain that a little more. How do you create this? Is it with effects, special effects?
Sure. It's a little bit, much of what we create and the style we create, we incorporate elements of, as I think I said, elements of circus and live music and recorded music and cinematic visuals.
Strobe lights.
There are strobe lights. We've got a big typhoon that happens. We're very interested in theatrical invention, and part of that is the audience and their imagination. When you read a novel, you've got a cinematographer and one of the great scenic designers, the best scenic designer, creating all the images in your head. The kind of theater that we do demands that the audience, and I think they love it, that they bring their imaginations too. We give you just enough information, hopefully, that you begin to see the whale that's played by a woman with an umbrella. You see it, you believe it. We give you enough text and visual information that you, as an active participant, an active audience member, not somebody who's passive and mm-hmm. watching it all play out for you. You are part of the theater event. And so Moby Dick is in a similar way. There's a line in it. These stage managers, the fates, put me down for the shabby part of the whaling voyage. And so this notion, and fate versus free will is a very important theme in this book and in our story. And so the fates are represented on stage by these three women, kind of in the traditional classic Greek sense. Mm-hmm. In the Greek sense, women would, that the three fates, there was one who would spin the thread of life, again, that metaphor of rope,
yep.
One who would measure out a man's thread, and one who would cut it, right? And so these fates are kind of ever-present. And when you think about, this book is very much a masculine story, very much there's a lack of women in it. And so to have their presence there, the fates are played by three women. If you think about it, ships are referred to with a feminine pronoun, right?
She.
They go out on the water, which again, I associate as a feminine element.
Mother nature.
Even amniotic, right? Yeah. All the life that is contained within. And they go make kind of war upon nature. Again, we think of Mother Nature, right? And in particular, whales. Whales we think of with a feminine pronoun. Thar she blows. Thar she blows, right? And so in our story, the fates play the wives and widows that they leave behind, and mothers, and they play literally the sea, they play the whales, they play nature herself, and thinking about what is Moby Dick. Moby Dick is his fate. It's Ahab's fate. This white whale, this blank, unwritten thing, event looming on Ahab's horizon, right? And so to have them play this thing that he is moving inexorably towards, immutably towards, is to me makes all kind of sense. And with the craft of the actors and the designers and the imagination of our audiences, that's how we make the impossible.
Awesome. Well, I know we're got to wrap up, but again, I just want to remind everyone, it's Moby Dick at Arena Stage, November 18th through the 24th. Just in closing, if they heard this and they said, that sounds awesome, what's the final sell? Why should they come?
Because it's breathtaking, because you think you know this novel, or you think you have an opinion about it, or you think it's boring and dull. It's not. It is vibrant. It is vivid. The characters are fantastic. The story is just beautiful, and I'm just very proud of this production and that Looking Glass Theater Company from Chicago and Arena Stage from DC, that we've come together to make for audiences here in Washington, D.C. and the surrounding area. I promise you, you're going to love it.
If audiences love it half as much as you are passionate, I think we're set, baby. This is awesome. David, thanks so much for coming in.
Jason, thank you.